So Kathy's been in the program for 30 years, and you can tell in our conversation. Sorry. Okay, I apologize. I didn't mean it that way, honest. This is my amend, and I will change my behavior. In our conversation, you can tell. I hear a lot of words of wisdom, and it's been absolutely great. So thank you for that. Kathy's very busy in service work. She has started a beginner's group. Oh, no, she's in leads a beginner's group. She has started a new group just down the road from her house. She's involved in women's retreats, and I love to hear about that. It sounds fantastic. So I'm really anxious to hear your story, Kathy. So please help me welcome Kathy.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kathy, and I'm recovering one day at a time in the worldwide Al-Anon family groups.
Hi.
Well, before I begin, I just want to thank, I think Richard for the invitation to come to Saskatoon to speak. He and Karen have been wonderful to me. And Sharon, I'm staying in her home. When I got there on Thursday night, she already had this wonderful meal already in the oven that she whipped out, and we've just had a wonderful time. It's just been, I've just really enjoyed my time here, meeting so many of you. Christina helped me with my poor broken leg. I mean, it's just been great. You know, it's interesting because Richard had told me earlier in the week that the Friday night speaker was out for health reasons, and he said, well, we have this other, you know, we've had another speaker out of California, a fellow named Nick, you know, out of Southern California. You know Nick from Southern California? I'm like, I don't know if I know a Nick from Southern California. Well, the truth is a couple of years ago when I was in Southern California, there was this young kid. I don't want to belabor the youth part because at my age, anybody under 40, I think, is a young kid, really. But there was a young kid, and I needed a ride somewhere back to the hotel, and somebody said, well, you know, he'll take you. And this darling kid drove me all over Venice Beach. We went here. We went there. I saw so much that I never would have seen without his wonderful and genuine hospitality. So imagine my surprise when I walk into Richard's kitchen, and there he is. It's Nick. I was like, oh, my gosh, I know you. So it's really it's been great to be here. I had a little trouble getting into the country only because I was the only one on the plane who was not armed. I said to the guy, he said, you wait over here. So I had to wait, and they went through my suitcase, and I said to the fellow that was going through, is it because I didn't bring a gun in? Is that why I'm suspect? He said, no, it's probably just random, but I was the only one, I think, that was checked. I don't know if you guys watch this comedy show, but there's this political comedy show I watch back in the States. And just this past week, they were talking about this new movie that's out yesterday, I guess, and it's about six people from the United States Embassy in Iran back in the 1970s when our embassy was overrun. And thanks to the Canadians, six of them got out. But it really was because of the cooperation of the Canadians over there at the time. And this political comedian was saying, you know, what is it about the Canadians? You can be in a major revolution in any country in the world, and a little car will pull up in the midst of grenades and machine gun, and it's got the little Canadian flag, and both sides say, oh, it's the Canadians. Come on through. Come on, you guys, come on through, because everybody likes them. So it's great to be here. Thank you. you know, I often say you know, Sharon just said, do you get nervous before you speak? I said, Sharon, the only thing I worry about is that I will talk too long, because there's nothing worse from my perspective than when somebody goes on and you're so happy for them, but you're also tired, you know, and you've been eating a damn turkey that's filled with that tryptophan, whatever it is, and you just want to go to bed. It's been a long day. So as my son often says, when he asks me a question and I begin to answer, he goes, as I start to answer, he goes, Mom, fast forward, fast forward, fast forward, fast forward. So I'll try to be as quick and concise as I can be. But I'll tell you that I grew up as a middle child in a very middle-class family in middle America, right smack in Ohio. I'm born and raised in Cincinnati, and I did not grow up with alcoholism. And I haven't said this in a long time, because my mother is 95, and she is very, very sharp and still drives a car. She is just she is unbelievable. And my fear is that she will ever hear me say this, and she will come after me. But because she would tell us stories when we were kids about her father. Both her parents were immigrants. And she would tell me stories when she was a young girl. Her father went to work every day for the gas and electric company, but he would always stop on the way home, you know, he'd get off the bus and stop at the local bar with a lot of the Irish who also, you know, would come from the same county. And she would say when he would walk down the street, he would be weaving. And as a little girl, I was so terrified that anybody would know that was my father, I would hide behind a tree. Now, that's a story we heard as kids. And I remember once I got into Al-Anon saying to my mom, Mom, do you think maybe you're Dad could have been an alcoholic? And she would say, and still says today, absolutely not. He was just an Irish drunk. We didn't have enough money for him to have been an alcoholic. So, you know, I just kind of let that go. But I know that there are patterns of behavior that I was raised with, that my mother will still say, that's the Irish, that's the Irish. And I don't really know how to separate all that out. I know that growing up in our house, what was important was our faith and humor. And anything that came along in my home life, you were expected to deal with it with humor and with your faith. My mother said and says, it'll all work out. It'll all work out. Don't worry. It'll be better. She used to say when we were little, it'll be better before you're married. You know, that idea that things really would indeed work out. The humor was another thing. For people of my age, and I think it's because we were raised by parents who came out of a particular time. When I was a kid, nobody asked me how I felt. They really didn't care how we felt. What was important is that we were, you know, we did as we were told. And we did not talk about any family matters outside of the family, because how things looked was very, very important. And my mother, as the daughter of immigrants, was really raised to fit in. So you just wanted to, you know, you didn't want to do anything that would call attention to yourself, that so anybody would think you were different at all. I mean, there was just a lot of that for many, many of my friends my age will tell me the same thing. It was the way that it was. And we didn't really question it. But you throw on top of that well over 16 years of an education delivered to me by nuns, and you just get a certain way of looking at the world. I mean, I was raised by women in education who constantly taught me the importance of doing for others. And they were, I mean, I know there are all kinds of horrible stories about nuns. I did not have those. I had really good women, for the most part, who taught us, you know, the secret to joy. This one little nun used to say, the secret to joy is Jesus, others, and yourself. And so early on, we were always taught to put ourselves last. It was not really very important how things were for me. What was important were how things were for you. And that constantly trying to make, you know, you be okay. And if I had a coat and you didn't have any, by God, the Irish Catholic guilt would force me to cut mine in half and give you my coat, even if I hated you, you know. But all that idea of offering things up and suffering, I mean, the importance of suffering, you know, but it had to be silent suffering or it didn't count. All of that was, you know, so many of us were raised with it. Now, I don't know what was different about me. Many of the people that I know, they heard the same, my brothers and sisters, I'm one of six, they heard the same things, but for some reason I must have heard it differently. I know that I was raised in a home where I trusted happiness. I was raised in a home where I felt very secure. I was raised in a home where, for me, I became addicted to approval, to living a life above reproach. And how things looked and being right became important to me. Now, we say in Al-Anon that we look at the past without staring at it. And I'm sure, you know, I mean, I have spent a lot of time going back over all that family. And really, you know, this is the thing for me. This is a program for my recovery. I am here today, and this is a program for my recovery. As kids, we were taught to laugh about almost, oh my gosh, everything. I mean, there was nothing off limits. We were everything we could you could poke fun at. And, you know, my mother used to say, when I would come home with all these tales of, you know, what we were being taught, she would always say to me, take that with a grain of salt. Oh, just take that teaching with a grain of salt, which really it helped me in the long run. But my father had this irreverent sense of humor, and I think a piece of it was because he was in the news business. And when we were really little, he was on radio, and as we got older, he was later on television as a newscaster. But those were the days when they had to go out and find the news. I mean, they would get to work and call the police and find what the story was, and then they would write the story and go out and do interviews. I mean, nobody brought the news to them. So my dad had this really, I don't want to say skewed sense of humor, but he found some of the craziest things to be kind of funny. I mean, when we were little, there was a woman in Cincinnati who had murdered her husband and chopped him up in small pieces and put him in a trunk and shipped him to Cleveland. We thought that was such a neat story, you know, as little kids, that she would do that and send it to Cleveland. I mean, why would you send anything to Cleveland? I don't know. My father had one sister and one brother, and the brother never married, and which is not so unusual. I mean, it may be now, but although I have a brother it's just a kind of an Irish thing, and I don't know. Anyway, so he lived with his mother, and when he was 48 years old, he dropped dead of a massive heart attack. And he had been, I don't know if you have the Hibernians in Canada, but he had been the president of the Hibernians in Cincinnati. It's this ancient order of the Hibernians. It's some grand old Irish order, and they all dress up with these plumed hats and capes and carry swords. And every St. Patrick's Day, they steal the statue of St. Patrick and hide it, and then it miraculously appears at the front of the parade on March 17th. And it's just a big deal. Anyway, so he has a massive heart attack and dies, my father's only brother. The Hibernians take it upon themselves to plan, you know, the whole wake. So I arrive, and all the Hibernians are there, and they're organizing this big group rosary to say for my poor uncle who lies dead in the casket. And as I walked up to the casket, my father is still standing there by himself, and I put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, "Oh, Dad, I'm so sorry, you know, your only brother, dead at 48. But look at what a nice job the Hibernians have done for him in his honor." And my dad looked at me and said, "This is nothing. At dawn, they're going to execute a Protestant." Well, I only tell you that story because that's how I was raised. I mean, nothing was serious. Everything's going to be taken care of. It's all going to work out. Don't you worry. But I'm a kid that always is following the rules, with a huge attraction to those people who break the rules. So, I'm dating a guy in college, a nice, kind, patient, loving, loyal young guy from Indianapolis, Indiana. And a friend of mine, a woman that I knew, a girl that I knew, called me and she said, "Hey, my brother's coming into town. He's in the Marine Corps and he, I can't find a date for him. I fixed him up with almost everybody I know, but I can't find a date for him. Would you consider going out with him?" Well, it was in the summer. Mr. Wonderful's back in Indianapolis. So I thought, well, sure, I'll go out with this guy. I mean, you know, it's during the Vietnam War. He's a Marine Corps pilot. It'd probably be fun. It's a patriotic thing to do. So I go out with this guy, and he arrives at my front door, you know, with a monogrammed silver cup that's filled to the top with bourbon. And I'm 20 years old, and, you know, I think that's really kind of classy or something. I don't know what I thought, but I thought it was kind of neat. And I, you know, didn't really think much of it. And so we went out and we had a great time. And he went back to, you know, training in Meridian, Mississippi. And then he would call again and he'd get up to Cincinnati and we'd go out again and we'd have a great time. Because he would do things that I had never known anybody to do. I mean, on a date, we would go flying. I'd never been in a plane before, but he would say, "Well, let's just go down to that little airport, the local airport, and I'll rent like a little Cherokee Cub or something." And we'd get in this little two-seater plane and, you know, he'd take it over the Ohio River and then he'd say, "Do you know what a stall is?" I would be like, "No." And, you know, and he'd stall the plane. And I mean, I'm a city girl. There's nothing I like better than the, you know, concrete under my feet. And here I am spinning out of control in this little two-seater plane. And at the last minute, you know, he pulls up. And I was just over my head, really. I said to his sister, "You know, I think I'm falling in love with your brother. Every time I see him, my heart beats faster." And she said, "That's not love. That's fear." The only red flag that I could see is that he always seemed to be angry. There was just a lot of anger. Now, I knew that his father was a well-known drinker. I'd heard about his father years before I had met any of the kids. And I knew his mother hit it pretty good, too. But I thought that if you had parents that drank like that, you would never drink like that yourself. I mean, that just made sense to me. Gee, if your father drank like that, and if your mother drank like that, certainly you wouldn't drink. So I wasn't really all concerned about the drinking. It was more about the unpredictability. It was more about the anger. But at 20 years of age and then soon to be 21, I thought, you know, I bet I can fix this. I bet I can make this guy happy. I mean, I'm pretty easygoing. I'm, you know, funny. I don't get upset about stuff. I have this firm belief that everything works out in the end. I bet this could work. And so one night when at Christmas time, at the time I was teaching school in Chicago, but I was home on vacation. He was up from, at that time, I think he was stationed in Havelock, North Carolina. We were having dinner at his home, and he said to his family, "I have an announcement to make," and he announced that we were getting married. Now, I didn't know he was going to make that announcement, because I didn't know, I mean, he had not told me. But see, I'm the kind of person that how things look is important, and so how would it look if I said at this family dinner, "Oh, now, wait a minute, I'm still under contract to teach school in Chicago. We haven't really discussed this. You've probably got to go to Vietnam. How's that going to work out?" No. What I did instead at age 21, almost to be 22, was just smile and nod and think to myself, "Well, you know, I guess we were going to get married anyway, and, you know, this will all work out. I'm sure it'll be okay." And so we got married. We got married in January. I got pregnant in February, and he got his orders to go to Vietnam in March. By the end of April, when he got on that plane to leave, I was so very happy. And I knew that wasn't normal. I was so relieved that he was going to be gone for a year because I thought it would take me a year to try to figure out what had gone wrong. You know, it wasn't any one incident. It was just a series of things that continued to throw me off, to surprise me. I thought I was adjusting to marriage, and what I was trying to adjust to was alcoholism. And there's no healthy way to adjust to that kind of behavior. I learned tricks that would keep me safe. I learned to keep my mouth shut. I learned to lay low. I learned to stay behind him at Marine Corps parties to warn you off from subjects that I knew were dangerous. I knew how to count drinks, because the more he drank, the quieter I would become. I knew to carry a rosary in my pocket for when we would drive home from these parties. And I don't know, there's something about pilots and speed. I just, you know, if the speed limit was 70, if I said, you know, honey, you're going 75, well, then we'd be going 120. And so all these little things that I thought would protect me from the disease of alcoholism, and when they didn't, I just thought if I had time, I could figure it out. Because it wasn't until I found you that I realized that I was playing a losing game. It wasn't until I found you that you really taught me the powerlessness that I had to admit to in order before anything would change. And so, much like, you know, we heard this afternoon from Michelle, I went immediately, when he took off for overseas, I went immediately to the priest that had married us, and I said to him, I don't know what's wrong, but something is terribly wrong in this marriage. I never mentioned the drinking, but all you had to do was look at me. I mean, I got married and weighed a nice, healthy 125, and now I'm like 3 months pregnant and I weigh 106. I mean, I was a wreck. I was just a wreck. And he said to me, with only the knowledge that he had, well, you know, you come from a long line of pretty aggressive women. I think probably you just need to take a back seat in this marriage. And I knew as I left that rectory, as surely as I knew when I left any place, that wasn't the answer. I didn't know what the answer was, but I knew that wasn't the answer. And it wasn't until I found you where I had that overwhelming sense that you had the answer. I knew it the first night I found you, you had the answer. Because I went to a lot of places. I mean, I went to people that would say, you know, try this, try that. You need to speak in I statements. So I would say to him, I hate you. That's my I statement. So anyways, you can imagine a year goes by. I can't figure anything out. I mean, nothing's, you know, I'm all constantly, you know, with his sisters. He's got five sisters who I adore and one brother. But the sisters and I would get together and we would talk about him and what's wrong with him and, you know, maybe this. And they would tell me about his childhood and what a rough childhood he would have. And I'm always looking for a key. You know, I'm always looking for, you know, the way to approach him, how to handle him that would change everything. You know, the magic words. And there were no magic words. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen. But for some reason, I thought if I talked to enough people, smoked enough cigarettes, you know, I'd get the answer. But there was no answer. And he came back from Vietnam and decided to use the GI Bill to go to dental school. And right before we left for Ohio State, he was beaten up badly in a bar. I mean, so badly that he had to have surgery on one of his eyes so that he could see out of it. And that frightened the both of us so badly that while he was in dental school, there was no drinking. And I thought it was because I had been patient. I thought it was because I had been long-suffering. I thought it was because I had been, you know, I had not been a nag. And I thought, yeah, those little nuns were right. You just have to suffer through. And everything does work out in the end. But unfortunately, once he got his degree and we moved back to Cincinnati, he can now write himself prescriptions for narcotics. And that was the next nightmare, because he wasn't doing that very long before he was caught, arrested, and thrown out of dentistry. And now we have a house full of kids, and he can't work. And we're living in a little house owned by his parents. His father owned and raised quarter horses, so they lived on a lot of property. And if you came to visit me in those days, you know that that driveway wound up to this main house that overlooked the Ohio River, all these wonderful pastures, and there was a barn and swimming pool, and then there was a little, what they used to call it, the summer house, where they used to put up vegetables back in the 30s and make jams and jellies, and that's where we lived because we didn't have any money to live anywhere else. And eventually we couldn't even pay, you know, the little bit of rent. And so things looked very bleak. But my biggest concern was that you would find out how I was living. That was my biggest concern. Because what would you think of me if you knew what I was living with? And so I did everything that I could to protect myself from your opinion. I pretended like I was living the life that I always chose. I would tell people that he was no longer in dentistry because he was really bigger than dentistry. He was a Renaissance man, you know. He had this wonderful garden. And I will say this about my husband. Everything he did so well. He was so talented. If he put in a vegetable garden, it was the greatest vegetable garden you ever saw. When he flew jets for the Marines, he flew them like, I mean, one of his fellow pilots told me, watching him fly a jet is like watching a concert pianist. He's terrific. Everything that he did well. But here we are, no real income coming in, and he's, you know, he has a vegetable garden. And then he raised bees and would sell honey. And then finally he took up fox hunting. And you know, well, it was a lucrative profession back in the 1780s. But in the 1980s, it doesn't bring in a lot of money. But oh my God, I made it sound like it was the greatest thing in the world. What's he do these days? Oh, he's in the fur business. That's what I would tell people. The kids would go off to school and they'd come home, you know, in the beginning in August, at the beginning of the school year, and you'd have to fill out all this stuff, father's occupation, and oh, that just to irritate me to no end, those nosy damn nuns. I would say, you just put down independent businessman. You just put that down. They'd say, but Mom, Dad doesn't work. Oh, yes, he does. Look at that vegetable garden. What are you talking about? You know, I was just terrified. It was like trying to keep this. I mean, talk about working yourself to death. You know, it's just trying to keep everybody away from the truth. I never thought of myself as a liar, but I'm telling you, I was lying through my teeth always, always pretending, acting as if. I mean, just, it was just awful. It was just, I was just running myself ragged and trying so hard to reinterpret my kids' experience for them. I mean, they would say, Mom, you know what Dad is doing? I would say, no, Dad's not doing that. This is what Dad is doing. And I'd just make it something completely different. Mom, you know what Dad just said? Oh, Dad didn't say that. This is what Dad meant. This is what Dad said. Don't take things so, oh. I mean, you know, he was such a great hunter. I mean, he could shoot a gun like nobody's business, but he was into birds, too. And he loved birds, and he would have all these bird feeders. And because we lived out in the country, he'd have, like, suet tacked to the tree trunk and all these hummingbird feeders. But he hated blue jays. And so he would sleep with the window open in our bedroom and a gun leaning up against the side of the bed, because God forbid if a blue jay came near any of his bird feeders. And this is what happens to me. What happens to me in order to live with insanity, I have to become a little bit insane myself. It's the only recourse I have. I have to stay one step ahead of crazy because I never know what's coming in the door. And, you know, it's that unpredictability that used to really set my teeth on edge. If he walked in the door and was in a good mood, why? I'd want to get in a good mood to take advantage of it. If he walked in the house and was in a foul mood, I learned to lay low and to try to keep the kids out of his sight. It's just the way that it was. I had no solution. And so he'd, you know, shoot these blue jays, and I would think, well, they are the felons of the bird world, you know what I, you know. And then these neighbors, you know, who were encroaching our farmland would call because they couldn't find their house cats. Now, I knew that he now had these infrared glasses that allowed him to hunt at night. And I said to him at one point, "You're not shooting cats, I hope." And he said, "No, I never shoot scrawny cats because I know they're hunting to survive. But if they're fat cats and they're house fed, they're just killing for sport. And those are our quail and pheasant. We have to protect them." So then I'd think, skinny cat, you get to live. Fat cat must die. I mean, it's just that kind of... And I have to make sense of it because otherwise I can't sleep. And you know what's sad? I love cats. So I stop answering the phone because I know where Boots is, but I don't want to tell this lady Boots is probably in a million pieces on my front lawn. So it's just easier to isolate. It's easier just to do that. And I'll tell you, I have friends today. Cincinnati's one of the, I don't know if Saskatoon's the same way, but in Cincinnati, a lot of people that grow up here, that grow up in Cincinnati, stay in Cincinnati. So, for example, I'm in a little book club that's going to meet on Wednesday. It's my grade school friends. There are four of us. It's called the Pathetic Book Club. And it's pathetic because we won't read the. I'll guarantee you on Wednesday night, two out of four will have read the book. We don't care. We don't even really want to talk about the book. We just get together and yak and talk and eat dinner together and have a great time. I almost lost my pathetic book club because it was just too hard to try to pretend like everything was okay. The last Wednesday of every month, I play cards with my high school friends. The same is true with them. I would come to play cards and I would be, "Oh, yeah, everything's great. Well, you know, has he found a job yet?" "No, not yet, but you know, he's selling honey." And no, yeah, blah, 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 blah. And I didn't know this till much later, but when I would leave, they would burst into tears. They felt so badly. But it's just, you know, what alcoholism did to me, it isolated me. And it isolated me from very, very important people in my life. I knew my parents were concerned from the day we went to their home to tell them we were getting married. My mother and father were deeply concerned. So I did everything to keep I did everything I could to keep away from them the reality of my life. But it just was too exhausting to go visit them and just put on this big happy face when I was just distraught. I was just bewildered and distraught. You know, we say in our opening, our thinking becomes confused and our perceptions distorted. And that's what happened to me. Everything got skewed. And I still have to be careful with that. I'm a swimmer. I think swimming is a wonderful way to start my day. I get up at 4:50 in the morning, and I'm underwater by 5:10. It's just a practice that I developed once I was in Al-Anon. It's calming. It's quiet. I love it. I came home from swimming the other day. It was about 20 after 6, and it was still dark out. And I went to make a left-hand turn to go home. And I saw, you know, I've got a lot of runners in my neighborhood, a lot of joggers. And I saw that jogger, you know, and I knew that I was going to make that left-hand turn and wasn't going to come anywhere near her. So I safely made the left-hand turn, and all of a sudden I hear this shrieking and screaming, and I thought, oh, you've got to be kidding me. I didn't even come near her. And I look in the rearview mirror, and she's, I don't know what she's doing, but she's waving her arms and shrieking at me, and I thought to myself, why can't those runners be like swimmers? I mean, we're just calm and quiet. And, you know, runners are all intense and crazy. So I go home and I try to pray, and I'm so upset about this woman shrieking and screaming at me because I gave her plenty of room. I didn't even come close to her. And then about a half hour later, my phone rang. It was my daughter. She said, Mom, I was out jogging this morning. Didn't you see me? I hollered and you waved and screamed and you just kept going. And I thought, you know, some things don't change. My perceptions still get screwy. But anyway, so here we are, and I don't even know where I am in the story, but things were bad, and I'm lying and covering and isolating, and one of my sister-in-laws joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was one that lived within this family compound, and then another sister joined AA, and then pretty soon I've got four sister-in-laws in Alcoholics Anonymous. And really, you know, they would come up because I lived in this little summer house by the pool, and they were so happy to have found sobriety. They always carried with them the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they talked a lot about alcoholism, and they talked about it being a family disease. And I knew what they wanted. I knew they really wanted me to join Al-Anon, but you know what? I had absolutely no interest. None. I don't particularly like group thing. I was very happy for them. But the way that I looked at it was this. I used to operate on what I call my 8-year plan. He was 4 years older than I, and women in the States generally outlive men by about 4 years. So I figured at the end of my life I'd have these 8 years of peace and quiet, or I wouldn't have to worry about answering the phone. I wouldn't have to worry about neighborhood kids getting caught in leg hold traps. I wouldn't have to worry. I mean, it would just be peaceful. That's all I was looking for, was this 8-year plan. And now they're talking about, you know, alcoholism being in the family. I'm pregnant with child number 7, and I'm thinking to myself, I will never get away from this insanity. It is going to haunt me for all my days. And so because of that, my 8-year plan in jeopardy, I decided to go to an Al-Anon beginners meeting. And when I went there, it was a meeting that was held before the regular meeting. There were very few, I think there were only 2 of us there. And I said to this woman, you know, I don't know that my husband's an alcoholic. He does not, I mean, I think of alcoholics the way my mother did. You know, you can't hold a steady job, you can't get out of bed. And I said to her, I really don't know. And she said, well, has his drinking ever been a problem for you? And I said to her, when he drinks, it's always a problem. Because when he drinks, somebody gets hurt. And she said, well, you're in the right place. Because Al-Anon is a program for you. So let's take your husband and let's just place him to the side. And let's just think about you. And that's what I heard. My very first exposure to Al-Anon was very clear that it was a program for me, no matter what anybody else in my life was doing. It was for me and continues to be for me so that I can recover from the family disease of alcoholism. And she said that day, or that evening, you know, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it. I never thought I caused it. But I always thought if I loved him enough, I should be able to control it or at least cure it. And I was killing myself trying to do that. And now, the first time ever, someone's saying to me, that's not your business. Really, he's not your business. You have to start paying attention to yourself. And so, for me, that was terrific news. And that was the news that kept me coming back for another meeting and another meeting, because it became very clear to me that you had what I wanted. You had what I wanted, and you were so valuable in teaching me those. You know, there in our literature, there's that quote from Thomas Merton that says, the beginning of love is to allow those we love to be themselves perfectly. And that's what Al-Anon taught me from the beginning. That, you know, I could allow my husband to be who he was. I didn't have to change him. And you were so helpful with all those little things like, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's a sick guy. And I had not been treating him like I was ever taught to treat someone who was sick. Ever. I was judging, blaming, criticizing, shaming. I was using that cruel humor that we have sometimes. You know, he was the butt. I used to say, oh my God, he has supplied me over the years with so much material. But he was the butt of all my jokes. I mean, I was constantly telling these outrageously funny stories at his expense. Not when he was around, of course. Oh, God forbid. And I would make sure he was off in the woods somewhere with a gun. But anyway, you know, and everything began to change when I began to look through this new lens of how you were viewing things. And that wonderful, you know, let go and let God. And what I have discovered and continue to discover is that Al-Anon is really a spiritual program that is rooted in letting go. It just requires me to let go of one thing after another. Let go of my idea of the way I think things should be. Let go of my ideas the way I think you should be. Let go of my ideas about the way I think my... I mean, it's just a spirituality of letting go. That's what you have introduced me to and continue to introduce me to. You know, I heard it over this, during this festival, this idea of, you know, you could be right. You could be right. Practicing saying that. That's very hard for somebody like me that always thought I was the keeper of truth and justice in that relationship. To learn to say, well, you could be right, was huge. And it's a stance that I have practiced in all areas of my life. I mean, I just spent 20 years teaching 17 and 18-year-old high school students. I can't tell you how terrific it has been for me to say to an irate student, you know, Marcus, you could be right. Well, it just takes, you know, it just takes all of the, it just diffuses so many situations that really should be diffused by allowing people to know that really I don't have a corner on the truth. I don't have a corner on what's right. To be willing to admit that I could be wrong in any given situation, in any given situation. And so those are the things early on, you know, that you taught me. The importance of, you know, we talk about insanity. How many years did I wait for somebody else to change? How many years just waiting for somebody else to change? And I find you and you tell me the importance of being the change, that I needed to be the change. And so I learned to rely on the wisdom of the group. That's what really, for me, my higher power, when I first came into Al-Anon, it was the wisdom of those men and women who were showing me how to live life from a place of freedom. And particularly today, to live a life from a place of freedom is very, very important. It's very, very important. But you're the ones that taught me that. You're the ones that taught me to turn my life and will over to the care of God and how important that is. You know, one time early in my own recovery, we thought it would be a fun thing to take the kids to this water park. And it was over in Indiana, in Clarksville, Indiana. And it had, you know, like a wave pool. And it had a pulley that the kids could hang on to and go over deep water and then drop. I mean, these kids are really little, too. But they always seem to like anything that could kill or maim them. So it just seemed to be a perfect place to take them. But we didn't want to tell them they were going. Because you'd get all kinds of arguments. They'd want to bring a friend or they'd want to bring a cousin or they'd want to bring, you know, all every toy they had ever accumulated. So I said, you know what, let's do this. Let's pack the car the night before with their pillows, with their pajamas, with their bathing suits, everything they'll need. We'll pack in the car, you know, underneath and stick it in those side things and under seats. And we won't tell them where we're going. We'll just say, let's go for a ride. They'll love it. So that's what we did. That night after they went to bed, we shoved everything under and any place we could find out of sight. And the next morning we woke them up and we said, well, we're going to go on a car ride. Well, they didn't want to go. Like, no, I don't want to go. Whining, complaining. It was like pulling teeth. I was so mad because I kept saying, you can't, you will love it. Trust me, you will love it. I know you. I know you better than anybody. You'll love it. And finally, they got in the car and they went to the water park and they had a wonderful time. That's what, you know, when I think about the third step, that it, I'm reminded of that morning. All I have to do is get in the car. That's all I have to do is make a decision to get in the car. Everything I need is in the car. It's all packed there, and I'm heading for a great place. But I have to let go. I've got to trust and get in the car. And that's really what you've taught me to do. You've taught me to believe in a power greater than myself that has my best interest at heart. And even when it doesn't look that way, it really is that way. But I don't know how to do that by myself. And that's why I've got to, that's why I call you. That's why it was so important for me to get a sponsor. Because together we take this journey. You know, all of the steps begin with we, not I. That's been pointed out to me a million times. We this, we that. It's never I, it's we. We do these things together. And so for me, it became very clear from my sister-in-laws, who were and continue to be shining examples of recovery, that what had really changed for them was when they got a sponsor and they had begun a fourth step. And so I knew that's something that I had to do. And so, you know, for 12 and a half years, I had been asking the wrong questions. What's wrong with him? Why would he do that? Why would he say that? And now I've got to put the focus on me. Now I've got to look at what we call in Al-Anon the four M's, the martyrdom, the managing, the manipulation, the mothering. I have to look at my own arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, which had destroyed love and respect in that marriage, and I had to become responsible for that. And I've heard it over these last, this day and a half. You know, it's more than just saying sorry. It is changing my behavior. It is making a living amends. And I was able to do that for my husband. I was able to go to him and say, I am so sorry. I placed the responsibility for my life and my happiness in your hands. And when you couldn't deliver on a job that was never yours to begin with, I punished you in a million different ways. And it was never what I said to my husband. It was the things that I didn't say, because I just retreated. I just built a wall and I ignored him. And that's probably the cruelest thing you can do to another human being, is to just simply ignore them, erase them as a human being. And that's what I did. And I had to make amends for that. And I shared that with my sponsor and with the God of my understanding. And it's through that sharing that I really learned to forgive. Not only myself, but to forgive others as well, and to forgive the world. I say that because I have a son who's in the military, and he's in his third deployment. he has two little girls. He's been gone half their lives. And he's in Afghanistan this tour, but his last tour he was in Iraq, and he flies Chinook helicopters. And I knew that he flew west of Baghdad, and I knew he flew at night because they fly at night. And one day I went to my computer, and I have one of those computers that the screen, you know, is the news. And I opened up my computer. It was on a Tuesday before my Tuesday night meeting, and it said, you know, Chinook shot down, everyone lost west of Baghdad. And I don't know if you've ever had that feeling that, like, your hair is on fire. But I felt like somebody had really set my hair on fire. And I immediately went to my email, and I just emailed him and said, let me know you're okay. And I pushed the send button. And then I went outside and I paced, because that's what I do when I'm upset. I paced. And I paced, and I said to the God of my understanding, I know this could be my child. And if it is, I also know that you have never, ever left me to face anything on my own. And I hope it's not my child, but give me the grace to remember that you will be with me always. And then I went to a meeting. And when I came home, I ran up the steps and opened my email. And there it was. Mom, I'm okay. That was my replacement crew. But I knew this, that there were five mothers that were not going to get that email that night. And Al-Anon allows me to live in a world that is not perfect. And it allows me to know that no matter my suffering, I walk shoulder to shoulder all the time with other men and women who carry great burdens on their shoulder. And in my meetings, I recover with men and women who have buried their children as a result of this disease and who have missing children, and yet they continue to show up and lead lives of service and compassion and love. And they're the men and women that I choose to hang around with today. And I feel so blessed to know them. So blessed to know them. I was not in the program very long before my own husband was killed in a helicopter crash. And it was one of those things that, you know, it was a hobby for him. He left one day, and I was coming up that long driveway with the station wagon full of kids, followed by the sheriff's car. I thought maybe I had been speeding, which would not have been unusual, but the police, you know, he pulled me over in front of the house and said, "Why don't you send your kids inside?" And I had a feeling what was coming. And as soon as the little kids got inside, he said to me, "Your husband has crashed and died." And I remember looking at those little kids, you know, who were staring out that little window of that little summer house and thinking to myself, how am I ever going to do this alone? And his mother, who lived in the main house, came up the driveway right after this news had been broken, and she was not well herself. She made her way over to me, and she wrapped her arms around me, and she said, "Thank God he's out of his pain." And, you know, that has always been the way that I have looked at my husband's death. I don't know why he couldn't get the joy that his sisters and one brother have found in Alcoholics Anonymous. He tried it, and it just frightened him. It just frightened him. I think that the joy or the promise or the hope was just too much for him. And so he chose not to go to meetings anymore, and he chose to go back to his old ways. And I know this, that he is today in a place of great peace because I believe he rests in the arms of a loving and merciful God. And that has to be enough for me, and most days it is. But now I'm left with these seven little guys. You know, they ranged in age from 14 to 2. And some of the older ones were already getting into trouble. And I will not bore you with 20 years of stories of their antics and escapades. But I will tell you this. They were horrible. They weren't really horrible. They were just kids. You know, they were kids who were being raised by a mother who was just trying to do the best she could. I had to go back to work. I had to find, you know. I mean, everything just kind of got blown up. But it was okay because I continued to do what I knew worked. I continued to stay in touch with my sponsor. I continued to go to meetings. I continued to be of service. I continued to work on the steps. I continued to, you know, pay close attention to steps 10, 11, and 12. All those things that you taught me, I did. And I never, ever had to do it alone. That was the best news. I took these kids to a grief counselor at one point. Oh, and they were just... they were so bad, he said, "Let's just make them wait in the waiting room." So we threw them all out and put them in the waiting room. And I said to this guy, "You know, I don't think I can raise these kids by myself. I mean, there's just so damn many of them." And he said, "Oh, you can't. You're understaffed." That was the greatest thing anybody ever said to me. "You're understaffed." So from there on in, I just did the best that I could do one day at a time. And I made a lot of phone calls to people in the program who were trying to raise children at a similar age. There's not a lot of help, or there wasn't then, for kids that fall between those ages, you know, of 12, 13, and 17. It's just, they're tough, tough ages. But, you know, there always seemed to be somebody that I could call, somebody that would give me a little bit more advice. One time I was with an AA speaker, and she was about to deliver a paper in Las Vegas on alcoholism in the adolescent. And I said to her, "Oh, please, what's the secret? What's the secret?" And she said, "The secret is that you cannot get them sober. But what you can do is just take little actions to interrupt their drinking and hope they stay alive long enough to get into Alcoholics Anonymous." And that became for me a plan of action. I no longer looked for, you know, the one thing that was going to cure them forever. I just did the next best thing as a responsible parent, and whatever that meant. I mean, sometimes the courts would get them, and I would always cooperate with the courts. But I will tell you, there is so much grief, and I'm one that loves to laugh, but I don't make the mistake of ignoring the grief that is involved in this family disease of alcoholism. Because I have had to see two of my sons appear before me and a court in shackles and handcuffs. And there's no inoculation for that kind of pain. It's just painful. But you don't have to face it by yourself. I have a network of men and women that have been there that have supported me all the way through. All the way through. And it doesn't help when your kids, though, particularly the drinkers, are so darn charming that everybody bends over backwards to keep them out of trouble. I mean, I have to beg the Cincinnati police, you know, give the kid a ticket, you know, or the courts, you know. But they're so cute. Everybody, you know, counselors and teachers, and they're really, you'd love my kids. You'd love them, especially if you're a drinker. You'd really like a lot of them then. But anyway, so just a few little things that I learned, you know, raising kids, is not ever to take them personally. They say the dumbest things sometimes, and they're not trying to wreck my day. I just can't take them personally. I don't really pay, I never did pay much attention to things they would say. It just doesn't, you know, they're kids, for God's sakes. I was the adult, but showing up for them, always important. And you're the ones that told me the most powerful amends I could ever make to my kids was to give them a healthy parent. And I have tried to follow that advice. You know, my son who's in the Army, he tells me that if they're captured, the rules for surrender are drop your arms and wait for instructions. And oftentimes in raising kids, that's how I felt, you know, to being powerless over teenagers. I dropped my arms and waited for further instructions. And it just seemed to work. I have great kids today. There are some that still drink. But you know what? They're surrounded by recovery. I have a daughter that called me 10 years ago and said, "Mom, I've got to quit drinking." And I said, "What's going on up there?" She lives in Chicago. She said, "You know what my husband just said to me?" And I said, "No." She said, "He just said to me, 'Honey, when you drink, I feel like I'm walking on eggshells.'" She said, "I know what that means." And so she said, "Do you know anybody up here?" And I said, "Well, I can get some numbers." And so I gave her a number. She called the number. And I mean to tell you, they had her the next day. And she just celebrated 10 years sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that we were talking about it earlier. I thought she was a pretty heavy hitter. But she wasn't the one I was concerned with. She wasn't the one that was getting arrested and beaten up. And, you know, the boys were the ones whose drinking I was more concerned with. And I have had a couple of boys who have been in AA sober. And they have decided, one has decided that AA is definitely a cult and those people aren't normal. And the other one has decided, you know, that he's really not done with his drinking. And my response has to be to both of these kids, you know, you could be right. You could be right. Because I don't know their answers. But I know one thing. I'm not in charge of their journey. And if I think I'm in charge of their journey, and if I try to be their higher power, they'll never find a higher power on their own. And so I pretty much, you know, live today in that 10th step, doing my own private inventories, you know, taking a look on a daily basis. Where have I been the woman that I believe God has called me and challenges me to be? And where have I not been that woman? But I couldn't do any of it unless I was serious about carving quality time out of my day for prayer and meditation. And for somebody like me that goes 90 miles an hour, really quiet, you know, ratcheting back, it's very hard for me. It is a discipline for me to try to meditate. But the fruits of that labor have been unbelievable. They have been unbelievable. I don't really know much else to say, actually. I'm probably forgetting some huge thing that I want to say. I will tell you this, that Mr. Wonderful from Indianapolis, who I threw under the bus in college, contacted me in 1998. And he said, you know, we used to have such a great time together in college. And then when I would run into him, you know, here and there over the years, he said, you think maybe it would be worth our while, if you're not involved with anybody, you know, to get together, now that I've moved from California back to Indianapolis, to get together once in a while, maybe for dinner. So I looked at this letter that he had sent me, and I thought, oh, really, do I want to do this? I mean, I loved being single. I could have been the poster child for single. I loved it. I would come home from teaching school on a Friday and I'd think, you know, I think I'm going to paint the living room bright red. And then I'd paint the living room. I mean, there's so much freedom in being single. Really, there is. I mean, dinners, microwave popcorn. I love a dinner of microwave popcorn. There's just so, you go to a party, if you don't like it, after 30 minutes you leave, you don't have to say, are you ready? I'm not ready. Are you? Oh, that's great. My single friends would say, but I just want somebody to bring me flowers. I'd say, oh, for God's sakes, you can get 3 bunches of flowers for $12 at Kroger. You can get the kind that you like. Buy your own flowers. This is great. But I know God, and I know God works in mysterious ways. And I thought to myself, you know, I owe it to the God of my understanding to at least have dinner with this old friend of mine. So anyway, in 2005, I retired from full-time teaching. My youngest son graduated from college, and Mr. Wonderful and I were married. And you know what's nice about it, really? He has 22 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was never married, has no children, which is what I call a double winner. And at our wedding, my youngest son's name is Daniel and was actually named after him. Because when we had this seventh child, we were like, oh, what are we going to name this kid? And I said to my husband, you remember that nice guy I used to date in college? Dan. Let's call him Dan. And my husband was like, all right, let's call him Dan. So we get married, and my little Daniel is the, you know, his best man. My, God love my red-haired Irish mother is my maid of honor. And as we walk down the aisle of St. Francis de Sales Church, it was filled with the Pathetic Book Club, with the high school bridge group, with our mutual college friends, with his grade school friends, his high school friends, and the recovering community. And as we headed down that aisle, everybody erupted into a standing ovation, not for us, but for a God who can bring great peace out of chaos and who can bring true healing out of deep woundedness, and who can bring so much joy out of a lot of suffering. And that really was the celebration of that day and continues to be the celebration of my life, because I believe that we are all invited into an intimate relationship with the God of our understanding. And for some of us, it's the ones we loved the deepest who inflicted a sacred wound in our hearts, which keep us coming back into that circle of love with God, because it's only the grace of God that can fill that wound that so many carry. I got my invitation through alcoholism, and I have no
I have no argument with that. It's just the way that it happened in my life. And so I continue, when I'm asked to be of service, to carry this message of great hope and promise when I can. And I continue to sponsor women and to generously listen to them. But, you know, I close always with the same story of a daughter who won a scholarship to St. Louis University. And at her commencement, the woman that was giving the address was late. And she was late because her little 7-year-old child insisted on reciting the Lord's Prayer that he had just learned to her. And she said to those of us assembled, you know, he stood before me this morning and he said, "Our Father, who art in heaven, how'd you know my name?" And that's what I think for me is one of the greatest gifts of this program as I journey through it with you, is that you have given me back a God who knows my name. And for that, I'm very grateful. Thank you.